for my own life as a husband, father, and minister. One night, Dad and I were watching a video of one of our church musicals. He looked at the TV, smiled, and said, "Hey, there's Shannon. Boy, you better hang on to that girl. Don't you ever let her get away. You two are meant for each other." I reminded him that we were no longer dating, but he continued, "Well, whatever you did, Bart, even if you don't know what you did, you're wrong, so get it right with her." We both laughed, but I took his comment to heart as his approval of Shannon and his blessing of our relationship. In the I Can Only Imagine movie, one of my absolute favorite scenes is when Dad looks at Bart and with a smile says, "Did I ever tell you how I met your mother?" Bart smiles and shakes his head. The scene fades as Dad's story begins. To hear my dad speak so fondly of my mom, like a real married couple would do, was really special to me. That was such a brief but beautiful portrayal of the many intimate moments Dad and I shared together in those midnight meetings. He told me hundreds of details of his life, confiding in me as a best friend. The Sewer Summer, my first and last real job. I was grateful that Dad was able to attend my high school graduation, although he was very sick. As summer began, I needed a job so I could make some money before I started college in the fall. After all, life still went on, and the bills had to be paid. So Dad contacted some friends and found out about an opening in the city water and sewer department. His likely motivation was to put me on a fast track to a city job so I could have a secure position in Greenville for the rest of my life. I interviewed and was hired. Journalists love to ask musicians what jobs they worked prior to their careers taking off. So many well-known artists have crazy stories about what they did before music. Well, I'm no different. In fact, I'll put my work history outside of music up against anyone's story. My duties at the city water and sewer department were simple. First, I was given the keys to a large tractor with a massive mower box underneath that you could raise and lower. I was supposed to cut the grass under and around all the city towers and storage containers. That part wasn't too bad, just really hot outdoor work sitting almost on top of a large diesel engine. But wait, there's more. Each week I had to go to the sewer plant and put on rubber wading boots, protective eye goggles, and a gas mask circa World War II, fire up a high-pressure water hose, and squirt all the human excrement that was caked up like concrete inside the tank, the goal being to force it down the massive drain in the middle. The aforementioned doo-doo was piled about 3 feet high all the way across the huge circular container. Picture standing in a giant commode that is backed up due to particularly large bowel movement, and not your own, by the way, and having to forcibly and manually flush it by applying a stream of water. I'm so sorry, I'm just trying to accurately paint this picture for you. The job involved more gagging than you would ever think possible. In the blazing summer heat, my sweat pooled up in the gas mask, and I would be forced to remove the antique apparatus to wipe my face off to be able to see. But that would expose my nose to the stench and trigger my gag reflex, causing me to throw up. I promise you I am not making this up. But that wasn't even the part of the job that ended my illustrious and short-lived career with the city of Greenville. One day I was mowing around a reservoir that had large steep slopes surrounding it. I tried cutting the grass by driving around the sides at an angle, but it freaked me out because it felt as though the tractor was about to tip over on its side. So I decided to try another approach. I would point the tractor at the hill, drive straight up to the top with the mower down, pick the mower up, then let the tractor coast back down in neutral. You're already saying, uh-oh, aren't you? The plan wasn't that bad except for one little glitch. At the base of the slope was a small concave concrete ditch for rainwater runoff. Driving across that little trench going uphill was no issue for the tractor, but coming back down was another story. When the back wheels hit the trench, everything stopped immediately. Now I was sitting at a critically steep angle with most of the weight of the tractor in the back. By instinct, I hit the accelerator and gunned the engine. The tractor didn't move, but the front wheels rose up off the ground. In the 80s, we call that popping a wheelie, but it was never meant to be applied to farm equipment. I'd obviously enacted some irreversible law of physics. There was no stopping the front end's backward arc. I was strapped in by the seatbelt and beginning to flip back. A thin metal awning on the tractor served as a sunshade, and I could hear the four support arms of the roof starting to buckle under the weight of the tractor. Then the truth registered, or an angel screamed in my ear, that once the weight of the tractor came all the way back, the roof was going to be crushed like a beer can on a drunken redneck's head, with me inside. Just before the moment of impact, I unbuckled the seatbelt and rolled out to the side onto the ground. the tractor finally got hung up enough that it stopped before turning completely upside down. But let's just say that the entire contraption was no longer drivable. It hung in a precarious position on the side of that hill. What did I do next? Well, I did what any irresponsible 18-year-old whose brain hasn't fully developed and who is scared to death but stinking mad all at the same time would do. I walked in my car, drove home, fixed a sandwich, and watched some TV. When Dad realized I had come home early, he asked, "Hey, why aren't you at work?" I quit. I hate that job, and I'm not going back. Ever. Ever. He never said another word. I never heard anything from the city. Maybe Dad took care of it. I really don't know, but we never spoke of it again. That was my one and only attempt at what Mama Millard would call a real job. While I know this is a comical and crazy story, God's guiding hand just kept gently pushing and leading me toward his plan for my life. I was placed on this planet for a reason, a mission, and God was molding and shaping who I would be, bringing about his will for my life, just as he is doing for you, my friend. Chapter 6. Finish what he started. No matter what you've done, grace comes like a flood. There's hope to carry on. He'll finish what he started. Mercy Me, Finish What He Started, from Welcome to the New, 2014. During almost every late-night conversation while the meds worked their way through his IV, Dad grew emotional and told me how sorry he was for the things he had done and how he treated me. He expressed how much he wished he could fix what he had broken, but he also passed on hundreds of invaluable pieces of wisdom he thought I would need as I navigated my way through life, marriage, parenthood, and my career. To this day, I find myself doing the very things he told me to do and constantly telling my own kids what he shared with me. One of the biggest victories that came from those middle-of-the-night talks was that I learned for the first time to trust my dad. Honestly, that is a miracle, something I never thought I'd be able to say, much less experience. Who would ever have known after the horrible impact he had on my childhood that those soul-sharing moments could make such a positive difference in the rest of my life? I had planned on going to Texas A&M University in the fall, and I attended orientation in early June. While I was there, Dad got really sick and had to go to the hospital, so I went home. That incident caused me to rethink moving so far away. I decided Baylor University in Waco would be a smarter choice. That way, if Dad took a turn for the worse, I could get home a little quicker. Kent was already at school there, and they offered me a small scholarship. But that August, as I was staying at Kent's place in the process of enrolling at Baylor, Dad ended up in the hospital yet again. So after two tries of going away to school, I decided being even a few hours down the road was going to be too difficult. After all, every time he went to the hospital, we feared it could be the end. I moved back home just before the start of the fall semester and enrolled in East Texas State University, which is only about 20 minutes from Greenville. I could commute to class from the house each day. Dad didn't want me to change my plan because of him, but I told him I knew I needed to be at home. I was all too aware that sooner rather than later, I could go to college anywhere. For now, proximity to Dad was my priority. Mirror image. There were times when Dad was so sick that he would cry out for me to hold him, or he would ask me to change him in order to keep his dignity in front of the hospice nurse. Those were very hard moments for us both, but we bonded during them. He trusted and depended on me, and I did my best to unconditionally love him. Even when something was difficult or gross, I had to get over myself and help take care of him for his sake. One particular day is forever burned into my memory. The hospice nurse needed to change the sheets on the hospital bed. There was not a comfortable place to move Dad, so I told her I would pick him up and hold him while she took care of it. Dad was down to around 120 pounds. I easily scooped him up in my arms and stepped back to give the nurse plenty of room to do her work. As I planted my feet to stand, I caught something out of my peripheral vision and turned my head to look. What I saw was our reflection in a mirror. There I was, staring myself in the face, holding Dad. He was limp like a rag doll resting in my arms. For all those years, I had been so much smaller than him, living in fear of this large, gruff, angry man, feeling so insignificant in his shadow as he towered over me with intimidation and disgust. Now the tables were so horribly turned, and he was completely helpless. I was the strong one, but I had no anger, no bitterness, no vengeful thoughts, only sadness and grief that my new best friend would be leaving me all too soon. In that moment, I knew it to be a privilege that God was allowing me to hold my father in the same way that my heavenly father had carried me for all those many years. In fact, in these final days, he was carrying us both. granting us the grace to see every hour we could spend together as a gift. Go chase your dream. So many incredible songs gave me strength and an outlet for all of my emotions and feelings in those days. Not long before Dad took a final turn for the worse, I was scheduled to sing a solo in church on Sunday, as I often did. Dad was, of course, too sick to go, but when he couldn't be there, he always listened to the service on the radio. That Sunday, I sang He's All You Need by Steve Camp. I still recall the lyrics. When you're alone and your heart is torn, He is all you need. When you're confused and your soul is bruised, He's all you need. He's the rock of your soul. He's the anchor that holds through your desperate time. When your way is unsure, His love will endure. A peace you will find through all your years, the joy, the tears, He's all you need. When I got home that afternoon after church, Dad called me into his room. He said, Bart, you have an amazing voice, and I know you can do great things with it. I want you to know that I heard you on the radio that very first time you sang at church, and I was so proud of you. What? I thought to myself, totally surprised. He had listened? It turns out that right after his exploratory surgery and his cancer diagnosis, he had tuned in to hear me sing at church, but he had never said a word about it. He went on to tell me that he had kept the radio on and listened to the pastor's message. Who would have ever thought that God would use me and my singing, something Dad had overlooked, to get through to him with the gospel? I was speechless. But now knowing what had happened helped me better understand so much more. As I sat down beside the bed, Dad went on, God has a plan for you with your singing. You're really good, Bart. Listen, playing it safe is just not worth it. Whatever you're passionate about, you need to just go for it 110%, all in. Don't let anyone or anything stop you, okay? Through his tears, he told me to not let anything stand in the way of me pursuing my dreams. Wow, what a turnaround from all those old messages he had preached to me about being realistic and taking no risk in my life. Dad then talked about my finances. Although he hadn't made much money at the highway department, he had set up his retirement pension to be awarded to Stephen and me. He said we could take a lump sum right away, but he really wanted me to take the amount in monthly payments over the next 10 years. This was going to be around $600 a month, which at that point in my life was an incredible amount of money. But then he explained to me the greater gift of why he wanted me to receive this blessing. I know for a long time I told you not to follow your dream, he said. That's only because mine never came true. You're not me. You're not like me. You have a gift, a real gift. I want to take care of you, Bart. I want you to have the money so you can give your full attention to singing, so you can go chase your dream. And I want you to catch it. Don't you ever look back. You promise? I nodded. I promise. With a slight smile and a sort of half-joking yet oddly prophetic way, he added, I don't know what'll happen after those 10 years, but I'm sure I'll find a way to keep taking care of you. Bookmark that line for later, okay? Not long after, Dad slipped into a coma. After a year and a half, our time together had come to an abrupt stop, forever. Just when I had become dependent on those late-night conversations. I know they say you should talk to people who are in a coma because there's a good chance they can hear you, but our back-and-forth dialogue was now over. His sudden absence created a huge void in my life. I wrote in my journal, the dad I always wanted and have just gotten to know is about to leave me. How is that fair? But during those many months, in the still of the night, while the rest of the world slept, the Lord had given me an example to follow, an example of who I wanted to be when I grew up. I wanted to be just like my dad in every way. Only God could have possibly orchestrated such an outcome. A bad word and a final breath. Remember when I told you about my super Christian season of life? One of the convictions I adopted during that time was that I never cussed. If I stubbed my toe or something scared me really bad, I used euphemisms or made up my own nonsense words, but I never used any of the major cuss words. I know the proper phrase is curse words, but hey, I'm from Texas, remember? We say cuss. When Dad would hear me use one of those substitute words, he would always ask, "Did you just cuss, Bart?" And I would respond with, "No, Dad, I didn't cuss. You know I don't cuss." But he would press and push, "Are you sure? Because I think for sure I heard you say a cuss word. Yeah, I think you did cuss." I would fire back, "No, I didn't. I wouldn't do that." So we had this ongoing game we played all the time about my cussing. For many years, even after he became a Christian, this was my dad's go-to inside joke. Stephen had gotten married my junior year of high school and moved an hour away. When the hospice nurses let us know that Dad's health had taken its final turn, Stephen and his wife, Darcy, came and stayed at the house. When he walked in the bedroom and saw Dad for the first time in a while, Stephen got visibly concerned. I'd been with Dad every day, and Stephen hadn't, so Dad's condition scared him. He motioned to talk to me outside the room. Bart, Dad looks really bad. He doesn't have much longer. What do you mean? I asked. No, he's fine. We have some time. I assured Stephen he didn't look that different to me. But something about that exchange made me paranoid that Dad would die when I wasn't in the room. I worried he might slip away while I slept, and I tried to stay awake all night. Sometime in the wee hours, I sensed the Lord tell me I wasn't going to miss anything. Everything would be all right. Finally, I dozed off. Early the next morning, I woke up with a jolt. My heart reminded me about Dad, and in a panic, I rushed into his room. My sister-in-law, Darcy, was there, sitting beside his bed. His breathing was labored, and he was still unresponsive, as he had been for a while, but he was still alive. Whew, thank you, Lord, I thought. But his feet were ice cold, which I thought was certainly not a good sign. So I went to get the hospice nurse. Just as I got past the bedroom door, Darcy suddenly called out to me, startled. Dad had reached out, his hand going for right where I had been standing. I was so surprised. I hadn't seen Dad move in the past few weeks. I ran back in and grabbed his hand. Stephen came in the room and from the opposite side of the bed took his other hand. Fluid was filling his lungs, just as a doctor years before had told him it would. His breathing became more shallow and faint, the breaths coming farther and farther apart. The hospice nurse counted the seconds between them and quietly, gently told us that his time was getting close. I watched the lack of movement in his chest. Finally, I was so anxious that I yelled, "Damn it, breathe." Dad took a normal breath. He nodded faintly, gave me a slight grin, and closed his eyes. And he was gone. As I witnessed this surreal moment, I went from crying to laughing. In his final moment of life, Dad had finally gotten me to cuss. I hadn't had any communication with him in almost 2 months, and now, in his last breath, he got me. He heard it, no mistaking it. He knew exactly what I had said. Game over. He won. Dad had nodded, smiled at me, and then left for heaven. That moment forever marked the kind of relationship we had worked so hard for and forged together over the previous 2 years. Dad went to be with Jesus on the morning of November 11th, 1991, just 3 weeks before I turned 19. The empty space and amazing grace. Dad died just after 9 a.m. We had to wait for Jerry and for Dad's brother, Uncle Mike, to get there, which allowed us to have a few moments together to say our final goodbyes. When the coroner took Dad's body out the front door, the hospice crew began taking all the medical gear out the back door. They wasted no time clearing the room. I assume their protocol is not to linger out of respect for the family. By noon, everyone was gone from Dad's bedroom, and I walked back in. I was not emotionally prepared for the life I had lived for the past 2 years to be completely gone in what seemed like a matter of minutes. That room had become holy to me, a sanctuary of healing and a place of grace. Now the room was empty. It was as if Dad had never been there. The finality knocked the breath out of me. I slumped down, melting to the floor. I looked around the room in the deafening silence and stifling absence. One of the few items left was a framed picture of Dad and me. Without warning, an engulfing wave of grief swept over and enveloped me. I started crying, then weeping, then heaving, and couldn't stop. My brother heard me, slipped in, and quietly closed the door so no one would disturb me. What felt like years of bottled-up tears flowed out of me for the next 3 hours. Especially for a guy, there are very few moments like this where you just cannot stop the emotion from taking over and pouring out. The emptiness in that room matched the new hole in my heart. I thought about all the late nights and the many words of healing and help Dad and I had shared. This room was the place God used to give me a real dad, a loving father, and an eternal example. This room was where, in my heart, God transformed the monster I hated into the man I wanted to become. There was a time in my life when, if Dad had died, I would have felt rescued. Honestly, I would have thought good riddance. But the change Jesus had brought in him over the past few years had also brought about a change in me. In fact, everything had changed. When we open our hearts up to Christ, that is exactly what he does. He'll finish what he started. The Cowboy Way. Several years ago, a country hit had the line, "Everybody dies famous in a small town." Well, as popular as Dad was, word had gotten out in Greenville about his death, and a lot of people had gathered at the house. Shannon, Kent, and several of my friends from the youth group were there. Uncle Mike, who was always funny, began telling stories about Dad. Mom had come too, and Stephen and I decided that her entrance would be a good time for a break. we left to take a drive. Here's another one of the Mama stories I promised you earlier. Mama Millard always watched a lot of the classic Western TV shows such as Gunsmoke, The Rifleman, and Bonanza, and listened to old school country and Western music, back when the stars really rode horses and the boots and hats weren't just props to create an image. At the end of one particular TV show she watched called Riders in the Sky, the characters ended every episode by reminding kids to do the right thing. They closed with, "Remember, it may not be the right way, but it's the cowboy way." Those influences showed up in Mama Millard's life in random ways. When Mom saw Stephen and me walk out the door, she asked, "Why are they leaving? What's wrong with those guys? Why won't they show any emotion or let out their feelings?" Mama looked at her, then looked out the window and said, "Just leave them alone. They'll deal with it the way they need to. It may not be the right way, but it's the cowboy way." Everyone must have thought, "What? The cowboy way? Bart and Stephen aren't cowboys. What is she thinking?" But that's the kind of quirky comment my grandmother would blurt out at precisely the perfect moment. It made sense to her, so it didn't matter who else got it. Over the years, Mama's classic cowboy way line has been a long-running Mercy Me inside joke. Now I've shared it with the world. Matters of life and death. To no one's surprise, Dad's funeral was packed. In the days after his death, a lot of people brought food and offered their condolences and support. But when the grief really sets in is when everyone leaves, when everyone goes back to their normal lives, everyone except you. What was real life supposed to look like now? I had no idea. After all, it was just Mama Millard and me, an 18-year-old and a 76-year-old living in the same quiet, lonely house. I went to Dad's graveside a lot. I also went through the normal ordeal of walking in the house, momentarily forgetting or denying his absence, and going to his room to check on him. I would walk over to a phone to try to call him. I would glance outside the house and think I saw him, and then I would remember he was gone. When I went through Dad's personal belongings, I came upon a box of letters and cards that I quickly saw were connected to Mom. They had been written in the past year. It was clear from reading Mom's response that Dad had apologized for everything. Mom also expressed deep regret for leaving him. It was obvious they had made peace with each other and wished they had worked harder to save their marriage. Dad actually stated in one card, "My biggest mistake in life was letting you go." Maybe deep down it was another reason why he had never remarried. To get to read my parents' words of reconciliation was an interesting but welcome bit of closure. Dad clearly did all he could to make things right with Mom and ask for forgiveness. All those times he had read through the Bible brought practical steps he had taken to leave his business here on earth in the proper order to be above reproach in the sight of God and man. In the following months, I realized how much harder Dad's death would have been for me if he had died suddenly. But near the end, I saw how much Dad was suffering and the pain he was in. I knew he wanted to be with the Lord. He was ready for heaven. That made my letting him go a little easier. For so many years, Dad's anger and pride had gotten the best of him and ruled our home. He could never admit he was wrong. I really believe that had he not gotten cancer, he likely would have died a bitter old man. I have heard many pastors over the years say that two of the most important words in Scripture are, "but God." When he shows up, everything changes. After just 5 years of growing spiritually, Dad was a man after God's own heart, the godliest man I knew. He was ready to go. He was so ready. He wanted to stop the chemo and the suffering. I learned from how he lived, but I also learned so much from watching him die. My dad had no doubts about where he was going. His faith was strong and his belief was certain. We can talk big about death in church and in Christian circles, but when you are staring it in the face, that's a very different perspective. My dad embraced his death and trusted the Lord. He persevered and knew God was in control of both this life and the life to come. No one else besides Mama Millard and me, the two people who had lived with Dad, had seen the change that Jesus had made in him. As we were driving away from the cemetery after the graveside service, Mama Millard looked at me with a sense of awe and wonder and said, "Bart, I can only imagine what Bub must be seeing right now." Chapter 7. Bring the Rain. And I know there'll be days when this life brings me pain, but if that's what it takes to praise you, Jesus, bring the rain. Mercy Me, Bring the Rain. From Coming Up to Breathe, 2006. When I was growing up, if someone decided to go into ministry, there was an assumption that he or she would serve through the few traditional positions available in the local church. Being involved in FBC Greenville's youth ministry had given me life and hope through tough times in my own journey, and I wanted the opportunity to pass that same love and care on to others. So I assumed my career path, coupled with my calling from God, would be college, seminary, and then a youth pastor position in a church. Even with Dad's encouragement and provision for my music, I decided to stay on the traditional ministry path. Dad died in November, towards the end of the first semester of my freshman year. In the middle of my second semester during spring break, Rusty called me. He had left Greenville during my junior year of high school to become the youth minister at Lakeside Baptist Church in Lakeland, Florida. He asked if I would sing at an event at their church, which I was glad to do. During that visit, the two of us talked freely, as we always had. In those conversations, Rusty offered me a completely new direction to consider. Move to Lakeland, work for him as his junior high minister, and enroll in the local university to continue my education. After such a difficult 2 years of caring for Dad, I was really ready for a change and desperately needed some new scenery. I accepted. Rusty had been an integral part of my life, and working with him was a great honor and awesome opportunity for me. I went back home to finish out my second semester. In May, I packed up my few belongings, said goodbye to my roommate, Mama Millard, and moved to Florida to start writing a new chapter in my story. I arrived just in time to join Rusty's summer student ministry program. I stayed in touch with Dad's girlfriend, Jerry, as much as possible. I would call to check on her and tell her what was going on in my life. It would have been so much easier if Dad had married her. Then she would have been my stepmom even after he died. Unfortunately, she felt less and less like a second mom to me as time went on. She eventually married another man, and I was really happy for her. When she died, I went home to sing at her funeral. It's funny how dysfunction can make blood relatives feel like anything but family. I guess it's like they say, you can't pick your family, but you can pick your friends. Jerry had certainly been my friend for all those years, and I am grateful to have known her. Planting roots. I lived with Rusty until I got used to the area, then I moved into an apartment by myself, enrolled in classes for my sophomore year, and started my ministry work. For the Wednesday night youth group service, Rusty had put together a worship band composed of high school students. I thought this was so cool. I had never seen a live band lead worship for a youth group, especially a band made up solely of students. The guitar player was a junior named Mike Schweitzer. We connected quickly, both personally and musically. With my love for singing and my desire to be in a band, it didn't take long before I was leading worship with them. So it was at that church and a youth group worship band instigated by Rusty that the nucleus of Mercy Me was formed. Our roots were put down there. While over the years we have experimented musically as all bands do, we seem to always return to this same kind of ministry, leading people in worship. The youth group gathering was called The Attic, so we cleverly named the worship band The Attic Band. We worked up a strong set list of popular praise songs, and soon other churches in the area started asking us to play for special student events, Disciple Now, weekends, retreats, and so on. When I was in high school, the Gospel Music Association, GMA, had put on a student singing competition in Dallas. I sang Stephen Curtis Chapman's Waiting for Lightning. The judges told me that I sounded great, but they didn't like how I was dressed, and they thought I needed to lose some weight. That was back before our politically correct days. But the one important encouragement the judges gave that has stuck with me all these years was that everyone who had competed should start writing original songs to perform. They told us that all serious artists who maintain longevity in the music business write and sing their own songs. Music is not just about how well you can perform, they noted, but about what message you sing to the masses. As Mike and I started playing music together, we began trying to follow that advice. As with all young writers, our first offerings were really rough. To quote Leon Russell, we sung a lot of songs and made some bad rhymes. But at least we were starting to hone our craft. Before long, when we played at events, we would do 10 popular worship songs that everyone knew and then throw in two of our originals. Miracle on the Mountain. During my days in Florida, there was a well-respected student parachurch organization we often hosted called All-Star Ministries. They traveled and put on weekend church events for youth groups with a secondary goal of recruiting students to go on short-term international mission trips to give gospel presentations. They came through Lakeland regularly and put on their program at our church. They asked Rusty to come with them on the weekends to help with production of their events, so he would leave on Friday and come home Saturday nights in time to be at church on Sunday mornings. After a while, Rusty began to burn out from working all week and doing the events all weekend, not to mention juggling the schedule conflicts between the two jobs. He asked if I wanted to replace him at the All-Star events. I respected the ministry and thought it would be a cool opportunity, so I accepted. The All-Star Ministries worship band was led by Jamie Smith, a young lady who had gained a solid reputation as a respected worship leader in student ministry circles. One weekend, she was scheduled to play at a different event, so Jamie's backup singer replaced her. Early on in the first set, she forgot the words to a popular song and froze. Freaking out a bit, she nervously announced to the audience, "Does anyone here know the words of this song?" Well, I had heard this set every weekend for quite a while. I had all the words memorized to every song and could sing them in the same key for a girl's vocal range that the band was used to performing in. High voice, remember? So I left the soundboard, ran up onto the stage, and finished the song. In fact, I ended up finishing out that entire set with the band. It felt very natural, and I connected really well with the students. Afterward, the All-Star leadership asked to talk to me. Jamie had been offered another touring job, and they wanted to know if I would take over fronting their band. Ready for just such an opportunity, I gratefully agreed. Isn't it amazing to look back and see the key moments when God orchestrates His will in our lives? Now I was in a worship band with Mike in Florida during the week and touring with Jim Bryson, who played keyboards in the ASM worship band on the weekends. Another member was added to the Mercy Me family tree. In 1993, Jim and I played an all-star youth camp in Switzerland for kids of military members and missionaries. One day, as all 300 students were gathered together outside, surrounded by the beauty and majesty of the Swiss Alps, we encouraged them to stand shoulder to shoulder in a circle. I jumped onto a large rock and led us all in an a cappella worship song. I'd never experienced anything like it. All those voices singing God's praises, echoing through the massive mountain range. To say it was incredible or amazing or awesome doesn't do it justice. That holy moment was the stuff of heaven, indeed a literal mountaintop moment. As the students lifted up their voices heavenward, something happened deep inside me. Gently but powerfully, God spoke to my spirit that He wanted me to be a worship leader. This was about something bigger, wider, deeper, and more permanent than what I was already doing. I realized that I wasn't going to wait until after college or seminary as I had planned. The time was now. It was my very own burning bush moment. God had spoken. Worshiping with those students in that setting made an eternal impact on me. I knew I had to be a part of leading songs of praise wherever God sent me. As I was standing on that physical rock in the Alps and on my spiritual rock in Christ, God connected my faith, my gift, and my calling for the rest of my life. On the long flight back home, I replayed the Alps moment over and over in my heart. At one point, I looked at Jim and said, "Hey, we have to do this. This is exactly what we're supposed to be doing. We need to start a band full time." After I got home from that trip, Mama Millard and I had a very honest conversation. I confessed to her that I hated college, which she was paying for. After hearing me out, she said she felt that if I did whatever I was passionate about, I would do well in life. She agreed to let me take a semester off to figure things out. She knew what Dad had told me about my music, and now she was placing that same belief in me. She knew it might not have been the right way, but it was the cowboy way. "You're called what?" Mama Millard often called me in Florida, and soon she started to realize I was always home, available to talk. In her old school estimation, she equated that with me not working. One day she asked me, "Bart, what exactly do you do all day?" "Well, I've got my calendar cleared because I think I'm going to start a band. All I need to do is come up with a name, and I'm good to go," I joked. "Mercy me, Bart," she shot back. "Why don't you get a real job?" And that is how our band got its name. Really, no joke, totally serious. Some artists have slick managers, marketing people at record labels, or public relations folks to help them create a catchy, trendy, memorable band name. Who needs all that when you have a mama? Living large at the daycare. I would not be returning to college in the spring, and Mike had just graduated from high school in Lakeland. So I convinced him to move with me to Oklahoma City where Jim lived. Mike was 18, so we had to convince his parents, too. For the three of us to start a touring band, we figured it made the most sense to be centrally located in the United States. The middle of Florida is a long way from most places, but Oklahoma City is right in the middle of the map, with three major interstates running through it. I worked for 2 years with Rusty at Lakeside before pulling up stakes and moving to Oklahoma. In 1994, 3 years after Dad died, Mike, Jim, and I started chasing the dream of a Christian group named Mercy Me. As only God could orchestrate, our first official show took place at the same camp in Switzerland where the original vision had been cast. Jim had a little recording studio set up at his parents' house, so when we came to town, Mike and I stayed in a camper in their driveway. Several months later, Jim told us he'd found a place where we could all live, with plenty of room for his recording gear. Intrigued, we went to go look at the property. We pulled up to the address only to find out it was in an abandoned daycare center. The windows were broken, and the inside was full of trash left behind by various homeless people who had been living in it. The building had been vandalized repeatedly. It was in really bad shape, so it had been for sale for quite a while. While we knew the building would need some work, we thought the layout was perfect for us. We called the owners in California, explained our situation, and asked if we could rent their building at a reduced rate in exchange for doing some upkeep on the place. They guess they figured some income was better than none because they agreed. We cleaned it up, fixed the windows, made the classrooms into our bedrooms, configured one large play area into a living room, and put a recording studio in the other. It was the perfect band house. Sometimes we invited a bunch of buddies over, opened up all the windows and doors, and played Capture the Flag. Nowhere was out of bounds. You could go anywhere inside or outside the property, even on the roof. This game was especially fun in the wintertime when it was freezing and there was snow on the ground. These were incredible carefree days. Well, most of them. There were also the tough days when the landlord would call about the rent being late or the phone company threatened to cut off our service if we didn't pay the bill. We didn't have the money, so we would call all over the area begging youth ministers to let us come play at something, anything, even for a love offering, so we could make it another month. Wouldn't our band adventures have made a great reality TV show? During this time, we met a bass player named Kendall Combs. Kendall played for other Christian artists and also did studio work. He was married, a little older than us, and more established. But the more we played together, the more we connected. Kendall agreed to become a full member of Mercy Me as our bass player. Now we had everything. Vocals, keys, guitar, and bass, covered by band members, except drums, which we hired various musicians to play. On the home front. On the morning of April 19, 1995, we woke at 9:02 a.m. to the sensation of the entire building shaking. Pictures we had hung in our rooms came crashing down. 25 miles away from where we lived in Edmond, a rental truck filled with explosives had detonated in front of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, and the nine-story structure was decimated in the terrorist attack. News reports said the blast was felt as far away as 55 miles. The rescue effort took 2 weeks as workers combed through the rubble. The death toll was 168 people, 19 of those young children from the daycare center located on site. It was a sobering time to be a band traveling the country to spread the message and hope of Christ when the eyes of the world were suddenly on our own town. Because we were a local band, we were asked to play at some of the funerals and fundraisers the community put on to help the families of the victims. We were humbled and grateful to serve in some small way at such a horrific time. Not long after, we had to play an out-of-town event and needed to rent some additional production gear. The best way to transport everything to the location was to rent a box truck. On the way out of town, we stopped by the church where Jim's dad was on staff to borrow some microphone stands. We pulled up to the front of the church in the box truck, noticing that the parking lot was full of cars. As Jim jumped out of the cab, the church doors flew open, and men in suits came running out with guns drawn, yelling. Unbeknownst to us, the church was holding a funeral for one of the ATF agents who had died in the bombing, and we had driven up to the church in the exact type of Ryder rental truck that the bomber had used. It never occurred to any of us what we were driving and how that might have affected people, especially so soon afterward and at an officer's funeral. Needless to say, we had some explaining to do. We felt horrible about the confusion and upset. We apologized profusely and explained the circumstances. Finally, we got the gear we needed and got back on the road. Our days in Oklahoma brought a lot of great relationships into our lives, ones we still have to this day. We've even gone back several times to play benefits to help the victims of other disasters that have occurred in that great state. Growing pains. For traveling highways and back roads to gigs, we bought a gutted out 1973 Silver Eagle tour bus to haul both people and gear. It wasn't much to look at, but the diesel dinosaur allowed us to have a place to sleep when we toured, since we couldn't afford hotel rooms. The entire bus interior was like a long hallway from front to back, lined with plywood. A family who owned a mattress company in Florida had given us a bunch of twin-size pillow-top mattresses, so we lined them two by two down the inside of the bus. We slept side by side and end to end. If the driver had to slam on the brakes in the middle of the night, Everyone rolled from the back to the front. It was actually kind of fun when that happened. Fortunately, no one ever got hurt, but it was a crazy way to wake up for sure. We took turns driving the 3-speed transmission behemoth in 3-hour shifts, trying to assure no one got too sleepy or fatigued behind the wheel. With Mama Millard's blessing and Dad's $600 monthly provision, I agreed to work full-time for the band. I worked the phones, calling churches and ministries to book us. I acted as agent, manager, and road manager, doing anything I could to keep us busy and get our name out there. The other guys got jobs to pay their bills when we were off the road. We led worship as the opener at a youth event in Oklahoma in which Audio Adrenaline was the headliner. They were one of the biggest and best bands back in that era of CCM. Their number one hits included what are now classics like Big House and Get Down. Audio A's manager was Scott Brickle, but everyone just called him Brickle. He is a mountain of a man, a no-nonsense, straight-shooter kind of guy. Trace Atkins was the perfect choice to play him in the film. As it happens, we almost didn't get to perform at that show at all. If we hadn't, who knows how our lives might have been different today. Here's the story. The woman sponsoring and promoting the event was a huge supporter of Mercy Me, and she called Brickle and told him she had a local band for the opening slot. She went on and on about us, so he asked to hear some of our music. All we had at that point was a very poor cassette recording of some of our earliest songs. Regardless, she got it from us and sent it to Brickle. He listened to the tape and called her back. Not one to mince words, he said, "I don't think this is going to work. I just don't think they're very good." She went on to tell him we were far better than the recording and that we were great with students. "Will you take a few days to pray about it?" she asked. Brickle agreed. The next week, the woman called back. "Well, did you pray about Mercy Me opening for Audio Adrenaline?" "Yes, I did," Brickle answered. "And?" "Well," he said, "God didn't tell me anything different. I still say no." A few more days passed, and determined not to give up, she called Brickle again. She explained how she really wanted us to play the event and hoped there would be more than just Audio A on the bill. Finally, reading between the lines, Brickle asked her, "Are you telling me that if I don't agree to your band opening for us, you might cancel my band?" She responded, "Well, I don't want to have to say that." The threat was clear, and Brickle gave in, but he insisted that we couldn't get on stage to set up or do a sound check until Audio A was completely finished and ready for the show, which might allow only 30 minutes for our setup and sound check. Thanks to some tough negotiations on our behalf, the deal was done. We showed up at the agreed time on the afternoon of the event and moved our gear as close to the stage as we possibly could without interfering with anyone. The show started at 7, and the doors were supposed to open at 6. Brickle finally cleared us to get on stage at about 5:35 p.m. We rushed to get set up, even carrying Jim's huge Hammond B3 organ up the steps to the platform. We were still trying to do a sound check when the back doors flew open and the kids started running in to get their seats. We wrapped up and went backstage to get ready. The event sponsor stood at the back of the venue during our set. Brickle said he had planned on walking up beside her, listening to about half of the song, telling her, "I told you so," and then walking off. Well, he listened to half a song, and then the rest of the song, and the rest of our set. After the show, he came up to us and said, "Gentlemen, I was wrong about you. You were really good, and you're great with the crowd. Very nice job tonight. I know you aren't at a place to be able to afford a manager, but if there is ever anything I can help you with, just let me know." At that event, we made a real connection with Audio A, particularly with Mark Stewart, their lead singer. They were all super nice guys and very encouraging to us. The introductions we made that night would turn out to be yet another major God moment for Mercy Me. Over time, we all became good friends, and Mark became our advocate in so many situations. He wanted to see us signed to a solid Christian label so that we could get our music out to as broad of an audience as possible. As for Brickle, well, he probably regretted his offer because I took him up on it in a major way. I called any time I had a question. Amazingly, he always took my calls, when I'm sure all kinds of crazy young musicians, just like me, were trying to get through to him. Every time, he did his best to help us at no charge. Let me tell you, that is not normal behavior for a music manager, Christian or not. Brickle's office manager, Kim Davis, told me several years later that she always thought I worked for a charity organization because of the word mercy in her name. Well, we were starving musicians, so you might say that she was right. First album and last drummer. Using our little studio in the daycare center, we cut our first independent record. We were blessed that Jim had attended Full Sail University, a comprehensive recording school in Florida, so he knew what he was doing. Our debut project was called Pleased to Meet You. Get it? Clever, huh? Having our first actual project with our own original songs began to open doors for the band. This was back when not just anyone could make a record in their living room, so being in a band with a record to sell was a big deal and offered some real credibility. One of the local radio stations even played one of our songs. While we didn't sell that many records early on, the project helped us grow as artists, expanding our reach. We hired the best studio drummer in the area, Trent Austin, to record with us. We hit it off with Trent and enjoyed working with him. Anytime we would get a gig, we would ask if he could play with us. Because he was our first call, we considered him our drummer. But he was in high demand and was often already booked. So during our stint in Oklahoma, we ended up using 23 different drummers. Yes, really. Some we hired once, others several times. One of the guys that Trent had mentored and recommended was Robbie Schaefer. He played for us several times, and we really liked him. So we finally realized it was high time to commit to someone and stop the drummer drama. Of all the guys we had worked with, Robbie played the best and fit the band the most. We asked him to officially join the band, and he gladly agreed. So not only did we have our first album release, but now the band lineup was complete. Robbie may have been the 24th guy, but since that day, Mercy Me has never had another drummer. Music City Madness. We enjoyed our simple and innocent days living in the converted daycare center, but we knew we needed to grow as a band, and Oklahoma wasn't exactly a hotbed of musical opportunity. I was well-versed in all things Christian music, so I knew that Nashville was the hub of the wheel from which everything in CCM spins. It was the home of record labels and managers and booking agencies and radio consultants and even tour bus companies. Music City, as they call it, was the one-stop shop. All the Audio A guys lived there, plus Brickle had been telling me if we ever wanted to give Nashville a go and play a showcase to try to get a record deal, he would help. As we got serious about relocation, Kendall, our bass player, told us he would not be making the move with the band. He and his wife were settled and secure in Oklahoma. We understood, even though it was hard to hear. So, sans bass player, Jim, Mike, Robbie, and I made the journey to the promised land of Middle Tennessee to see what God might do with our boots on the ground. As a young band of starving artists with no money, we needed lots of space for cheap. Today, East Nashville has become, for the most part, the land of trendy coffee houses and hipster hangouts. But this was in the mid-1990s, when the sounds of sirens and police helicopters were a nightly event in the area. We found a 5,000-square-foot, three-story dilapidated house in a very bad neighborhood on the east side for a price we could afford. We assigned rooms, moved in, and set up the studio. One night I came home and found Jim outside in the backyard with a .22 rifle pointed at the rear porch staircase. "What in the world is going on?" I asked. He said, "I figured out that rat that's been getting into the kitchen is coming in at night through the hole in the back door." About that time, just as Jim had predicted, the rat showed up and headed for his dinner reservation in our house. Jim fired the .22, pumping several rounds into the back stairs. He did eventually get the rat, but I was certain the police would be swarming our door any second. Minutes went by, then a half hour. We finally realized that random gunshots were so much a part of the nightly neighborhood sounds that no one even called the police. All about that bass. Soon it was time to hit the road. We had summer youth camps booked for 2.5 months straight, and we had already been subbing in bass players for Kendall. Robbie told us about a guy back in his hometown named Nathan Cochran. Nathan, who was dating Robbie's sister, played bass and guitar and was a really nice guy. We asked him to join us at a camp, and he agreed. It turned out to be a great week, and everyone loved Nathan. Jim was especially impressed after Nathan offered to jump in and help him work on the bus. I think that counted just as much in Jim's mind as being a great bass player. So in the summer of 1996, 6 months after Robbie joined the band, Nathan came on board. Little did we know that this lineup of Mercy Me's members would last almost 20 years. When God shows up. The long-running five-step strategy in Music City to be signed by a major record label and make it in the music business is to play what is known as a showcase. Number one, book a local venue with your band as the only performing act. Number two, stack the audience with your own rabid fans, encouraging them to convince anyone within a 5-mile radius that you are the most incredible artist on the planet. Three, invite every record label's A&R, artist and repertoire, person to come hear you. Four, consider all offers, take the best one, and sign a major record deal. Five, become rich and famous. In reality, steps four and five rarely happen. but every young band or artist believes they will, and Mercy Me was no exception. Step one, after attempting to book a few venues, we finally realized that our church home would be our best bet. All of us went to First Baptist in Smyrna, a southeastern suburb of Nashville. When we weren't on the road, we led worship for their youth group, so the church staff graciously agreed to let us play in the sanctuary. Step two, working with the student pastor, we told the youth group about the showcase and asked them to come and invite all their friends to pack out the place, scream, stomp, yell, applaud, and sing along at the top of their lungs. Well, those kids did not disappoint. Pack it out, they did. And get into the songs in a major way, they also did. They covered this step of the showcase plan in major league style. Step three, Brickell called in some favors and invited every Christian record label in town. At this point in our career, we had 10 solid original songs from our debut album, standard pop rock CCM tunes about God and faith. At the showcase, we performed every song to the very best of our ability, but there was only one problem. When we finished the set, the students, whom we had told to go absolutely bonkers, just kept cheering for more. They stomped and clapped and shouted encore. Why might this be a problem, you ask? Well, we didn't have another song ready to go. We hadn't considered that scenario. We had played literally every original song we had, but the kids just kept cheering for more. I peered through the curtains at the record execs who were waiting to see what we were going to do, but they weren't applauding. They weren't even moving. They were just watching the stage like hawks waiting for the field mice to get desperate and run out into the open. So we did the only thing we knew to do. We went back out and led worship, just as we did all the time with those very kids every Wednesday night. It was incredible. It was like the Swiss Alps moment, but in the hills of Tennessee. The final song we did was called Behold the Lamb of God, a powerful and anointed anthem. When we got to the final chorus, we stopped playing and let everyone's voices take over. The crowd sounded like an army of angels, so we slowly backed off the mics. We quietly slipped off stage, and the crowd just kept going. Behold the Lamb of God who takes away our sin. The kids in the audience were still singing with everything they had, pouring out their hearts to God. You know true worship is taking place when no one notices the band has left. Off stage, we were all in tears, listening, realizing this was the most important moment of the night. Forget steps 1 through 5. Forget the record execs. Forget the contract. Forget our band goals. This was why we do what we do. In Jesus' name, amen. As the crowd stopped singing and people slowly began to leave, some of the record label folks found us. One said, "Your set was great, guys, but the really powerful moment where you connected with the crowd was that last song you did. The problem, though, is the whole worship thing. That's what Integrity Music does." Integrity was one of the only record labels at the time solely producing praise music. "Sorry, but we just don't think we can market what you do, so we can't offer you anything." Down to the last A&R person, that's what they all told us. At that moment, I had flashbacks of my dad telling me I wasn't good enough at football or would never be as good as he was at something. Rejection still sat at my front door waiting for an opportunity, way more than I would often admit. But this particular time, I was not just hurt. I was really angry. I thought, market what we do. Are you kidding me? How did you miss out on what just happened? Can't you see there's something special to how people respond to these songs? To say the guys and I were frustrated was a serious understatement. Disillusionment was thick in the air that night. While our performance of our original song was great, we didn't have the right material for a deal, so the labels weren't interested in signing us. No one wanted to take the risk on the revelation and divine connection they had witnessed. The whole idea of a Christian band leading worship and singing mostly vertical songs to God versus songs about Him was still a new concept. Just a few years later, the emergence of bands like Sonic Flood and Delirious, along with the growing popularity of movements like Passion and Hillsong, made worship music a widely accepted genre. In fact, for several years, the entire Christian music industry was almost solely producing worship songs. I guess we were just a bit ahead of the curve. Timing is everything, as they say, but God's purposes will always prevail. A clear word and a fresh wind. We understood that the events of that night were certainly a word from God. It put an end to my desire to be signed by a record label. I was officially done. Not with Christian music or the band, of course, but I marked record deal off the band's to-do list. The next day, we started talking about what to do next. We had a history of being nomadic, so leaving Nashville and moving again wasn't a big deal for us. Around the same time, Mark Matlock, a popular author and speaker, had a major touring student conference based in Dallas, Texas, known as Planet Wisdom. He had called to ask us to start leading worship at their events, and we decided to accept his offer. It made sense for the band to be based in Texas and for me to go back home. I called and asked to meet with Brickell. Because of all the help he had given us, especially setting up the showcase and pulling favors, I owed him an explanation for why we were leaving town. We set up a meeting at the food court of the Cool Springs Galleria Mall. Brickell brought Mark Stewart, Audio Adrenaline's lead singer, with him. After they heard me out, both guys were adamant that we did not need to leave. They feared we might lose momentum or even quit after leaving Music City. Especially back in that day, there was a definite attitude that the only way you were going to make it in Christian music was to be based in Nashville and signed to a major label. I assured them that Mercy Me was going to continue, but trying to partner with the CCM industry was no longer our heart. We had given it our best shot. We knew without any doubt that God was calling us to focus on the worship music that we had now seen him use time and time again. If the market wasn't here for what we were called to play, then we would do it from somewhere else. Brickell and Mark understood. They gave us their blessings and yet again offered to keep helping us in any way they could. So we said our goodbyes. Allow me to offer you a word of encouragement. Regardless of what you do for a living, what stage of life you're in, or what your dreams and goals may be, during our time in Nashville, our sole focus was to be signed by a major Christian record label. At some point that year, 1996 to 1997, we had the attention of and were in the running for a deal with almost every major label. But each time it would come down to us and another band for the one contract slot they had available, and every time the offer was given to the other band. That scenario happened 4 or 5 times that year, but we did not quit. We heard from God and chose to obey his calling and direction. Today, by God's grace, we are still at it, still making music, still making a living, still touring, still getting radio airplay, and still selling well. We all face really hard seasons when it seems as if the entire world is against us, when we think we just cannot win. But when we keep standing strong, following the Lord and obeying his calling, he will see us through and keep us on his path. We're living proof of that truth. God made it very clear to each of us that Mercy Me's mission in this new season was to help feed the growing hunger in the body of Christ for this fresh wave of worship music. As our song says, I know there'll be days when this life brings me pain, but if that's what it takes to praise you, Jesus, bring the rain. Chapter 8. Beautiful. You're beautiful. You are treasured. You are sacred. You are his. You're beautiful. Mercy Me, Beautiful, from The Worship Project, 1999. No matter what was going on in our lives, Shannon and I always stayed in touch. We never went too long without one of us reaching out to the other. No matter where I was in the country or how busy she was at college, we always found time to talk regularly on the phone. She would tell me about her relationships and I would tell her about mine. Typically, we would tell each other that whomever the other one was dating at the time wasn't right and that it was never going to work. It was our regular thing to discourage each other about anyone we were dating. While Shannon was attending Stephen F. Austin University in Nacogdoches, Texas, about 150 miles southeast of Greenville, she dated a guy she ended up being in a relationship with for 6 years. 6 years. She grew up in a stable home with parents whose marriage was solid, so when she committed, she committed. I dated a lot of different girls over the same time period, and the relationships lasted anywhere from just 1 or 2 dates to several months. But as girls came in and out of my life, Shannon remained the one common female thread throughout. When I was in Florida working with Rusty, she called to say her family was coming to Disney World for vacation and they wanted to see me. I invited them to stay in my apartment so they could save money on the trip. To the outside world, we seemed to have a super close brother-sister relationship, but in reality, it was much more of a best friend scenario. Built on this strong foundation, our friendship always had potential to turn into something more. No matter where I lived or whom we dated, Shannon was a constant source of stability throughout my crazy, nomadic life. Love is a battlefield. In December 1996, just before the band moved back to Texas, Shannon called me in Nashville. She and a friend had just finished their college finals and were thinking about making a road trip to Music City. Because the band was living in the previously mentioned East Nashville house, complete with bullet holes in the back porch stairs, I told her there was plenty of room. They were welcome to stay with us, and we would give them their own bedroom and bathroom for privacy. I didn't mention the rat problem. What I had failed to understand was that part of Shannon's goal in the visit was to hang out with me. I thought she wanted to sightsee with a friend and have a free place to stay. After all, she was dating the 6-year guy, and I was seeing a girl in Nashville. I took her to dinner one night and we caught up, but I was busy the rest of the time. I didn't know she was upset that I hadn't made much time for her. Shannon's side of the story. I got to Nashville and Bart was dating a girl there, but we've always been able to hang out no matter whether either of us was dating. I was thinking we were going to spend some time together, but I quickly saw that was not going to happen. We did have dinner one night, but then the next night he was sitting out in the driveway in the car talking with